generous support. Thanks for your extra massive support during the membership drive. A reminder that all new and increased gifts to KBOO are matched one-to-one through the end of this year. Thanks to the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Go to kboo.fm and click on donate. Good night, Kanan.
Good night, Lisa.
Good night, Wesley.
Good night, Wesley.
Good night.
Time is now 5:59 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Buyer and Seller, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from November 25th through December 17th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Buyer and Seller, the story of an underemployed Los Angeles actor who goes to work in Barbara Streisand's Malibu, California basement, allowing for delicious wit and commentary on the solitude of celebrity, the love-hate attraction between gay men and divas, and the melancholy that lurks beneath narcissism. Again, that's Buyer and Seller, November 25th through December 17th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, the transportation choice of Portlanders since 1946, with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab has a mobile app that allows you to book a cab with your phone, available at the App Store, Google Play, and at radiocab.net. Or, if you prefer, you can talk to a real person at 503-227-1212.
It's a little past six. We have Preference Radio coming up next. This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by a grant from Seattle Theater Group presenting comedian Tig Notaro performing at Revolution Hall Friday, December 16th. Tickets are still available for her 10:30 performance. And more information for Tig Notaro on December 16th can be found at revolutionhall.com. This program has also been made possible with Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Welcome to Preference, dear listeners. This is an experiment in queer radio. Welcome, and thanks for joining us here on KBOO. I'm your host, Alan. I'm very excited about tonight's show. We have a series of audio clips pre-recorded. They're going to take us all the way around the world and take a look at some of the perspectives that queer folks have had on looking for safety and dignity and community in past decades and in now this troubling time. We're going to start with a series of audio recordings made by a local artist just in the past couple of weeks. He's been working on these. Jason T. Ingram. He's a gentleman who, in his younger days, ended up in gay conversion therapy in the South. We've chatted with Jason about this experience before, not least because there's an organization that is in Clackamas County that continues to promote conversion therapy, though it itself is, I believe, illegal in the state now. And still this impacts Jason's experience a great deal. He's turned to his art as a way to tell the story, and I asked him to help give some perspective on what we're about to see. Looks like the anti-gay religious right has a seat at the table now in the White House. And so I asked Jason to give a perspective
banana boat dessert hot.
On apologies for that. That wasn't part of it. Anyway, I asked Jason to give us his take on his personal take on what we're looking at and what his background can inform us. So we're going to hear a series of four clips. We're going to start with Jason Ingram. Thank you.
This is Jason T. Ingram. I'm a Portland native and survivor of conversion therapy. I'm reading from an excerpt from a piece called They Called It Mercy. This is from a book called A Queer Disability Anthology, compiled and edited by deaf and gay author Raymond Luzak. And this is a piece that he wrote for me based on a 40,000-word conglomeration of 5 years of doing anti-gay therapy in a couple of different states around the country when I was in my late 20s and early 30s. They called it mercy. My flight from Alaska to northern Kentucky left late at night, so when I got to the airport, I fell into a daze. It was like I was there but not there. I was so overwhelmed with fear, confusion, and second thoughts about what I was doing, I retreated somewhere inside of myself like a turtle. I tried to remind myself that I thought I was doing the right thing. A part of me was mentally exhausted from fighting my feelings constantly, so when I sat down at my departure gate, my mind was out of control. Every man who caught my eye made me think of taking him to a private place. Then I was afraid of what I would do. That caused more anxiety on top of my lust. I was 31 years old. I could not sleep at all on my long flight to Seattle, but managed a few winks on its last leg to Cincinnati International Airport. That next day, still in a daze, I studied over and over again the complicated pickup instructions and found the place where I would take a van for the ranch. It was a cold winter Ohio afternoon, and even though I was coming from Alaska, I hadn't expected such harsh weather. I finally spotted a large maroon van with an adorable older driver who was my type. I immediately got afraid of my thoughts, yet in the van, I felt at ease a bit since Brother Jerry had such a calm presence. But at the same time, I couldn't look at him. I just looked down or at the window on this new part of the country. He then told me that I was assigned to be his student and him my counselor. The trip to the live-in program site took nearly an hour. We arrived there just at the end of dinner time. They managed to fill a plate of food for me, which was nice because I was starving. There was a student who was still finishing his dinner, and I was introduced to him. He was a mean-looking with a light mustache and lots of tattoos. He just stared at me. Then I learned I wasn't supposed to shake anyone's hands. In fact, I was not supposed to touch anybody. After dinner, I was given a brief tour of the campus, which was an old cattle ranch. The sun was just setting and the weather was bitter. I was taken into the counseling office for a briefing. I was a total emotional mess. I was given a list of a dozen assignments, many of them due the first week, including signing legal paperwork. I was to study the live-in manual, remember a long list of written rules, and sign the legal release form. This form protected them from malpractice lawsuits and other legal entanglements. This scared me. This form seemed to give them the ability to do almost anything to me, and it took me a while before I would read and sign it. One of the questions people have about the Pure Life's residential program is if they do force the students to stay there. The answer is technically no. There are no barbed wires or doors that lock from the outside. Men can leave without being chased by cops and big guns and slobbering barking hounds. The reality for most of the students and interns and most of the staff is that if someone leaves, there is a large chance of him being brought to financial and emotional ruin. Later that first evening, I was shown my dorm. While I was getting oriented, a pastor gathered up as many of those who were staying in the dorm for a brief meeting in the small commons area. The meeting turned out to be just him yelling at all of us about how immature we all were. I was terrified. The pastor had these piercing eyes, a thick New York accent, and a very militant, forceful voice. He did not need to yell at us packed in such a little, small room. While the men were asleep, I was a bit late in getting ready for bed. Andre, one of the leaders, took me to the commons area. He told me that he had read my file and that he knew about my, quote, issue. He explained that I had additional rules, like how I should sit and how to keep my gay background a secret. He spoke in a voice very close to a whisper. He was taller than me. He had a very, he was very dark and slim. What was strange about him, like so many in the ex-gay movement, was how effeminate he was. You would think that if he rose to such power in the years in this organization, that he would have changed his mannerisms to act, quote, straight. My bed, number 9, was a droopy old bunk right over a student who had arrived shortly before I entered the program. He was a real crusty. When he took his shoes off to lay in bed, his feet smelled so rank that I had to turn around so my head was facing the other way from where his feet were. Later that week, I found myself unable to sleep. A man detoxing off crack cocaine was very vocal, and our stuffy and smelly room containing 16 men was at maximum capacity. The sound of men snoring, creaking their old army-style metal bunks would have driven anyone crazy. On this particular night, though, I snuck out to the next building where the counseling offices were. I climbed to the top of the stairs where there was a locked door. I curled up in a ball near the landing of the darkened stairway and lay there terrified. I was trying everything I could to hold on and to not lose my mind. I felt so cold, depressed, and worthless that I wanted someone to take me to a mental hospital.
You're listening to Preference Radio here on KBOO. I'm your host, Alan. We're listening to a series of performance pieces compiled, created by local artist Jason T. Ingram, who endured gay conversion therapy in the past. I'm going to take a little bit of a turn in style here. He has taken the audio, the words to the speech delivered to incoming Vice President Pence that the cast of Hamilton delivered recently and put them to music. We're going to hear that, and then we're going to go back to more of his narrative experience in looking at religious fundamentalism and sexuality.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. You know we had a guest in our audience this evening, and Vice President-elect Pence, I see you're walking out, but I hope you will hear us for just a few more moments. There's nothing to boo here, ladies and gentlemen. There's nothing to boo here. We're all here sharing the story of love. We have a message for you, sir. We hope that you will hear us out. And I encourage everyone to pull out your phones and tweet and post, because this message needs to be spread. President-elect Pence, we welcome you and we truly thank you for joining us here at Hamilton, an American musical. We really do. We, sir, are the diverse America who are alarmed and anxious that your new administration will not protect us, our planet, our children, our parents, or defend us and uphold our inalienable rights, sir. 5, 6, 7, 8. Truly hope that this show has inspired you to uphold our American values and to work on behalf of all of us, of all of us. Again, we truly thank you for sharing this show, this wonderful American story told by a diverse group of men and women of different colors, creeds, and orientations.
You're here on Preference Radio. We're listening to local artist Jason T. Ingram give his thoughts on religious conservatism and their attitude towards sexuality and politics in a series of performance pieces.
This is Jason T. Ingram. I'm going to read some excerpts from an article that I had written the early morning of Saturday, March 19th, 2016, and I had published it on my Facebook. It's called The Psychology of Trump, and I will basically go to the end right now so you can see where I'm going. The last sentence says, that is why I believe that Trump is going to be the next president of the United States. I hear a lot of people asking why are people supporting him? And then why did he win the primaries and why did he win the election? And I live a lot of my life because I live in entertainment. I'm open about being gay and mentally disabled and even my pot smoking. So I'm very much on the far left in my world, although I try to keep one toe in the far right because my 12 years in fundamentalist Christianity, it's still a part of me and I still try to keep an eye on what's going on. And I was really surprised when they started endorsing Donald Trump as a candidate. And there were groups of evangelistic, very kind of militant Christian groups. And they reminded me of the kind of groups that I used to hang out with. So I wrote this article thinking, oh my God, he's going to be the next president. And it's an okay article. I'm not the greatest reader. I'm going to just read a little bit of excerpts here. It's The Psychology of Trump. It's published on my Facebook. From Jason T. Ingram, Saturday, March 19th, 2016. It's obvious that Donald Trump is the biggest bully in our nation, or at least pretty close. It's obvious how crooked he is. I wonder if he's using all of this bull as one of his tactics. If so, check this out. It's a case of Oliver Twist. Oliver is alone, hungry, and desperate. Fagin seems like his only option. Therefore, I wonder if people who see no hope but to turn to what they think is the lesser of two evils, or will they choose someone who shares their beliefs or their actions? Trump is one of those narcissists who wants to be on top no matter what. First, businessman, then television personality. Besides being a rock star, there's only a few things yet, starting a religion or running the most powerful nation on earth. He could start a religious cult. He'd be a badass church guy. But then again, he reminds me of a lot of preachers I've seen. Let's face it, we have the most powerful military and we heavily influence much of the world's cultures. Being the president can be the greatest ambition, besides, of course, going to Mars and back. He's got enough money to do that. It's so hard to figure out his tactics. I see him all over the media, yet people don't see him as a serious threat. Most people I know just want to joke about him. When he started to campaign, I thought that he had enough chances Frank Zappa did. I just thought he just wanted more attention. Now that he's being widely successful at his campaign, I'm wondering what he has up his sleeve. He's not as stupid as he acts. If so, he would be poor. Most guys that talk like he does would blow through $1 million easily. Donald has done very well, and I don't think it was at all an accident. I can imagine that he's taken from a lot of people, so I don't actually admire his success. But I do think he is smarter than he acts. I think he's playing the bad guy for a reason. Think about it. Every candidate gets a lot of negative press. If he beats everyone to his own negative press, it just makes him seem, for lack of a better term, a little more honest. If people say he's being a jerk, it's one thing, but if he's being a jerk on record, it's taken differently. His goal is not to be rational or to have good ideas or to make any logical sense. He just wants votes. We happen to live in a nation that has huge populations of people that fit Trump's personality. The idea that everyone likes a winner also applies here. If a child is being bullied, one strategy is to join the bully, especially if the child sees no other option. There's a huge number of voters that would just want to vote against a Democrat, no matter if it's a pig or even a pig with lipstick. They will vote for someone who says they will uphold their views. It's obvious that well, and then I go on about his views will change once he reaches the presidency. And, well, his views have changed about every week or so now. So let me go on to say here in the last couple of paragraphs here. So when it comes to psychology, people's brains are activated differently based on various stimuli. If you see sex or food on TV, those parts of the brain are activated whether we like it or not. Whether Mr. Trump knows it or not, I personally believe that he is activating a primitive part of people's brains when he speaks. It's obvious that he is not targeting intellect. He is using an old-fashioned tactic used by cult leaders, abusers, and dictators to basically brainwash people. He goes right for triggering an autonomic response that's an important part of human survival. It's what people call the fight-or-flight panic mode. Whatever you call it, it's like everyone is carrying around an interface to have others upload whatever they want into your head. So, unless you're not aware of this, or you are vulnerable, you can be swayed by nonsense like this in the same way that I have been and millions of Americans are. The most vulnerable people, I believe, are those who have had a lot of trauma, and thus they are in a state of, quote, alert most of the time. These are fearful people that are always prepared for conflict, see conflict everywhere, and even create conflict. That is why I believe that Trump is going to be the next president of the United States. I was reading a couple of excerpts from a piece I published on Facebook called The Psychology of Trump, early morning on Saturday, March 19th, 2016. And you can find that on my Facebook, Jason T. Ingram. I'm saying this today because I am a survivor of conversion therapy, and that has become a real hot topic lately because of Mr. Pence and some of his views. And I also wanted to share, not because I'm some kind of prophet or you know, even somebody who understands politics. It's just I made a lucky guess, and I put it online publicly, and I'm just telling you that I came to that conclusion because I always like to keep an eye on the far right. And the far right, I mean, in particular, born-again, Bible-believing Christians, which was basically what I was. And I identified for 12 years and even after that, for several years of my life, identifying with those people and trying to get this Bible culture in America and trying to have it as a global force. And I think there's a big link between this Bible culture and between the world that Donald Trump is trying to create here in America and maybe the whole world. So,
we're here on KBOO, Preference Radio, an experiment in queer radio. We're listening to Jason T. Ingram, a series of pieces he made on religious conservatism and queerness and where we're at today. We're going to listen to one final piece by Jason right now.
My name is Jason T. Ingram. I spent thousands of dollars and 5 years of my life participating in the ex-gay movement, which included attending a straight camp. During this time, I suffered mental, emotional, religious, and verbal abuse, false accusations, and personal trauma. I'm convinced that these testimonies from these successful ex-gays can be disproven. I'd like to talk to you about something I'm calling both sides now, trying to understand the religious right and our role. Something here I'm also calling disguised as compassion, conversion therapy, which is also called reparative therapy, is any kind of therapy or practice to try to change somebody's sexual orientation. Because I grew up in the Portland counterculture and in very close to the LGBT community and during the AIDS crisis in the 80s. I had a very interesting perspective going into the born-again Christian world, having lived so far on the political left. This
form of anti-gay therapy, what I'm calling it, is sort of their form of compassion as opposed to trying to pass laws to make life difficult for us and take away our rights. The rise of Pentecostalism has a lot to say when it comes to people that are trying to change their orientation, because there's these spiritual experiences that they have and they try to interpret them in the context of this very strict biblical ideology that they believe that their whole life needs to be centered around. And that's the way I did. I put myself through these programs. Nobody forced me to, but there was a lot of subtle pressure and there was a lot of fear. So people often ask me, why? Lived with an untreated mental illness and these people accepted me when nobody else did. Yeah, they hate big, but they also love big too. These, quote, successful ex-gays and these testimonies that people hear really seem to validate any kind of anti-gay therapy because they bombard the internet with all of these stories. Basically, a lot of them are bisexuals that are just swinging from one way to the other. And then there's some people that are just so full of discipline and accountability that they just don't have time to have gay sex. And then some people are too old and they don't have their sex drive like they used to, and they might not have access to it. And of course, there are some people that just plain lie about it. Now, all of these programs are pretty much all different. They have the same purpose, but they don't always admit that they're changing somebody from gay to straight. The laws in America have been limiting them, but the international outreach has been a really big deal. So we are exporting the anti-gay theology, like to Africa, for instance, and we are now exporting this false myth of conversion therapy and things like that, too. So it becomes difficult in America, and it's going to become probably a lot easier for these people to do that, even to minors. So why are they afraid of gays? I think they were afraid of us for the same reason that they are afraid to speak against Israel, because there's things in the Bible says that God's going to bless your nation if you bless Israel and stand with them. And they're also afraid to be a part of anything that looks like it could become a one-world government. So they probably don't like the UN. And if they feel like they enable homosexuality or a part of it at all, that there's going to be some kind of demonic curse on this nation. And they're scared that we are going to be cursed like the nation of Haiti or something like that. Though they bombard the web with things. Anybody who wants to try to get into anti-gay therapy, they can find something within seconds. There is one in Southeast Madison, and this is called the Portland Fellowship, and they are still going. And it is a residential anti-gay therapy type program. They won't admit that, but if you call them, they will probably give you their spiel like they did me and other people. But the one I'm really trying to raise awareness about is sort of what I consider the next embodiment of what was Exodus International that closed down over 2 years ago. The Restored Hope Network, they are based right where I live here in Milwaukee, Oregon, and I have met with some of them and tried to dialogue a little bit, but this is something that Portlanders, they just shake their heads and they say, no, this can't happen here. But yes, the Willamette Valley is actually quite a place on the global map of ex-gay activity. Now, I would like to bombard the web with the real experiences of people like me who have been traumatized.
We've been listening to local artist Jason T. Ingram talk about his experience in gay conversion therapy. and some of the implications of how the religious right might act and think about sexuality as they become ascendant in some ways in American politics. We're going to hear a little musical break. I just want to thank Jason, though, for creating these pieces and sharing them with us. So grateful. We're going to hear some audio clips later in the show of other takes on queer experience. But first, we're going to hear Billy Bragg. Which side are you on?
Clem Attlee held the bankers to their responsibilities. He made them pay their taxes in that you set them free. The Big Bang blew the walls down, the bankers got away. Snaps till we bailed them out. Now everyone must pay. Which side are you on? 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 The left is dead. The media said that's a goddamn lie. That which they could never kill went on to occupy. In the camps, the watchword is accountability. In Wall Street and in London, we demand transparency. Which side are you on? 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 We have the best democracy that big money can buy. The markets call the tune, and soon our leaders all comply. Come all you greedy bankers, as well. We're here today to chase you away and build a better world. Which side are you on? 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 Through this world you travel, you meet some funny men. Some rob you with a six gun and some with a fountain pen. Through this life you ramble, you'll never see an outlaw take family from their home. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
All right, we're going to take it a little further back in time before we bring our show background to current day issues for queer and trans folks. We're going to go back and listen to part of a summary that was created and produced by the Fruit Punch Collective of KPFA Berkeley. This was a summary of a conference in 1976 called Faggots and Class Struggle.
One criticism that I heard when I first saw the brochure for this, and people up in the Bay Area were starting to relate to this, was that they thought it was a little off the wall that men were going to sit here and talk about socialist feminism. I just want to respond to that and say that my understanding of socialist feminism is that it's been put forth as a strategy for revolution. And in that context, I think that we have a responsibility as socialists to talk about that, to get in dialogues about what that means. I think there's a big difference between that, though, however, in talking for women.
Aside from being a strategy for revolution today, feminism has always been a basic part of the gay liberation movement. Only in the past few years, with increasing co-option from traditional mid-America of the gay liberation movement, have these feminist roots been obscured. It's no accident that gay men share many of the same oppressions of women, nor is it any accident that when looked upon as classes of people, women and gay men have a lot in common. In many cases, our demands for meaningful work, the rights to our own culture, the rights to our own bodies, and the rights to raise our children result from a common analysis of our oppressions. Tom will now briefly run down the basic tenets of socialist feminism, the necessity of leadership roles for women, the close connection between the personal and the political, and the interconnectedness of sexism and capitalism. The conference he refers to took place a year ago in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Socialist feminism contends that women are central to the revolutionary process and crucial to its success. And actually understanding the character of socialist feminism is to realize that female socialists and socialist feminists are really two different things. While traditional Marxists see the women's movement as just another group oppressed by capitalism, socialist feminist thinking acknowledges the critical and primary importance of women in any upcoming revolution. Barbara Ehrenreich made a speech which included a little bit of this discussion. And she said, "When I say critical importance, I mean not in an auxiliary role or not as a minority group that needs to be appeased by revolutionary forces. I mean women as a revolutionary force, as a leading force." The next area of basic characteristic would be the connection between the personal and the political, which the women's movement and the gay movement have really advanced a lot in the past 5 years. Again, another quote from a woman at the conference. "The personal is political is a crucial perspective because it legitimizes people's experience of alienation and oppression by acknowledging that what people already feel to be important is important. It is a starting point from which we can understand day-to-day reality. From here, we can go on to understand our experiences differently than when they first occurred to us. By making the connections between our own and others' experiences, we begin to demystify and struggle against bourgeois ideology that we have all internalized." The last major point is in the area of the primary contradiction for women. Socialist feminists feel that their political outlook is necessary because sexism and capitalism form one integrated system. This principle is particularly relevant to the women's movement, where a lot of energy has gone into debate over which is the primary contradiction, sex, the antagonism between men and women, or class. Socialist feminism maintains that sexism and capitalism complement one another and cannot be separated, as it demands that the Marxist method and analysis be applied to areas where it's never been applied before. In the past, socialists generally have been concerned only with that part of life directly organized by capital, specifically production for profit and the activities of the state that maintain capitalism. But areas like sexuality, lesbianism, raising children, just the personal life in general, haven't really been dealt with in a Marxist framework before until recently.
Feminism has been criticized for its bourgeois tendencies, or for only relating to upper and middle class people. This same criticism has been made of the gay men's movement. In their rush to neutralize any potentially revolutionary energy, those in power have rushed to co-opt both the women's and gay movements. We've all seen this in action. The Advocate in an editorial tells us that we are worthwhile people because we have inviting homes and inviting bodies. The drag of Folsom and Castro Streets mimics that of our oppressors. A gay political leader tells us that the solution to high rents is buying our own homes. Another gay publication appeals to us as America's most affluent minority. The list goes on and on, but the message is always the same. We are not oppressed.
There's a corresponding tendency, I think, among men like ourselves, mostly white gay activists, that reflects a lot of the basic perspectives of socialist feminism generally across the country. A lot of men, I think, who identify with this outlook support feminism and generally support socialism in principle and tend to be somewhat hostile toward the organized left because of its male dominance. But a lot of the support I feel for socialist feminism appears to be really naive, and more often than not, I think it's real uncritical. I think the logic that a lot of us have had at one point or another, or maybe still have now, is just an overly simplistic look at socialist feminism and saying that since socialism appears to be right on and feminism is right on, that it's just going to conclude that socialist feminism is going to meet a lot of our political needs without really examining a little bit deeper the political perspectives of that ideology. I think tied in real deeply with such a blanket acceptance of women-defined politics is a real dangerous subservience to any political outlook that comes from women without checking out a little bit of the class and racial background from that political perspective. Reflecting both its class and its racial composition, the gay men's movement, like the women's movement, has leaned heavily toward political reforms. Its program has benefited middle-class white gay men the most, many times at the expense of third world and working class brothers. Organizations like Gay Activist Alliance continue primarily to serve the interests of white middle-class men, sometimes giving strong verbal support to third world struggles, but maintaining organizational power among middle-class men, whether they're liberals or socialists in those organizations. Within the growing socialist pro-feminist tendency among gay men lies many of the same racist and classist political assumptions and errors that exist among the socialist feminist tendency in the women's movement. Unless we acknowledge the importance of third world and working class leadership in the gay liberation movement and act concretely on that acknowledgement, the ideas and perspectives of gay liberation will remain isolated among middle class gay men and lesbians and are never going to really reach deep into society. Our role as gay people in any upcoming revolution is going to depend entirely on liberating the gay liberation movement, seizing power from the middle class white men who dominate it, and putting that power in the hands of working class and third world gays who have a real profound stake in building a people's movement in this country.
We've briefly heard some of the main tenets of socialist feminism, as well as a major criticism of it. This sets the stage for a discussion of a basic thrust of many of the conference workshops: how the American social and economic order invalidates our lifestyles and feelings, both in the workplace and outside of it, through sexism. In his analysis, coming up, Jamie sees a necessity for third world and working class input and leadership, two sectors largely ignored by most feminist and gay analysis of sexism. The women's and gay movements grew and gained strength due largely to the energies of white middle class people. While not consciously working to invalidate the oppression faced by third world and working class people, these people ignored the super exploitation of the third world and the struggles of working class people. A lot of this was due to the class backgrounds and the cultural conditioning of those having power in the gay movement. Jamie clearly says that any valid analysis of sexism must focus on the needs and material conditions of the third world, working class, and poor people, and must incorporate people from these classes in leadership roles in any organization working for social change.
What I want to talk about today is how rich straight white men, the ruling class, uses all these divisions, the class divisions, the race divisions, the sex divisions within the working class to their benefit. And in particular, I want to talk about how sexism divides people against each other. I'm not going to go into all the ways that sexism rears its ugly head. Because the conference is focused on class struggle, I'm going to focus on the economic guts of sexism, which I see as the sexual division of labor under capitalism. Any attack on the sexual division of labor is ultimately an attack on capitalism and the boys on top, because it's a step toward uniting the full power of the working class. The family also teaches children to depend on adults for answers, students to depend on teachers for answers, workers to depend on bosses for answers. It teaches us to focus on others for fulfillment and direction. The family teaches us sex roles, and then it teaches us to fall in love with our opposite, heterosexuality, instead of falling in love with ourselves and looking to ourselves for direction, homosexuality. And the family teaches obedience to authority. It teaches us to be passive, a setup for good students and workers and soldiers. Finally, consumption. The family acts as an isolated unit in competition with other families. It's a primary means of marketing all the useful and useless junk that capitalism produces. And here, the housewife, again, is the primary purchasing agent. Now, in all this, of course, the primary producer is the housewife mother. Now, the relationship of the housewife mother to the capitalist class is a basic worker-boss relationship in which her labor is exploited. Now, if there's a husband, his role is like that of a foreman, you know, like a straw boss. And he often carries the messages from the bosses, the bourgeois messages. And he has privilege, but he essentially is out of control of the work that women are forced to do. The big bosses need the family as a social unit of production. And this need sets up the condition of women in all realms of society. It doesn't matter if she's a housewife mother, she's a single woman, a divorcee, a lesbian, a welfare mother, a student, a social worker, a hooker. It doesn't matter. The discrimination that she suffers, her low pay, The dependency and humiliation that she's forced on her all results from a need to have her redirected into the family to maintain that profitable slave labor. Okay, now the work that's open to women for wages is primarily an extension of the unpaid work that she does in the family. It's all essentially the kind of social service work that women do in the family, only in this paid sphere, as well as the social conditioning work that women do in the family. In the paid sphere, it comes out as social work, counselors, teachers.
We are here on Preference Radio on KBOO. We were just listening to 10 minutes of a summary produced by the Fruit Punch Collective of KPFA Berkeley after a conference in 1976 called Faggots and Class Struggle. We're going to take a turn around the globe with This Way Out. They're going to it's a syndicated queer news programming. We're going to hear first about what Trump is deciding when it comes to how to stock his cabinet.
Say what you will about him, you know, with women and Latinos and other constituencies, he hasn't flipped and he hasn't said anything. He hasn't screwed up on any LGBT stuff yet.
That was gay California Republican Donald Trump supporter Charles Moran the night before the U.S. presidential elections. The operative word there may have been yet. Virtually every nominee Donald Trump has named so far for high-profile positions in his administration has a solid record against LGBT rights. Topping the list, of course, is his vice presidential pick, Mike Pence. The Indiana governor currently also leads Trump's transition team that includes staffing his administration. Pence is probably the highest-profile Christian conservative Republican in the country.
Leading the rest of the pack is Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions, full name Jefferson Beauregard Sessions. The Alabama senator has a notoriously racist and homophobic record. The suggestion that he become the nation's top law enforcement official has prompted an unprecedented letter to the Senate, which must approve most cabinet-level positions, from some 150 U.S. civil rights groups asking that the Sessions nomination not be confirmed. The groups include the Human Rights Campaign and the National LGBTQ Task Force. The letter notes that Sessions supported a proposed constitutional amendment defining civil marriage as exclusively heterosexual, opposed the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and opposed the 2009 law that added sexual orientation and gender identity to federal hate crime statutes. This is particularly disturbing, the letter says, at a time when there have reportedly been more than 700 hate incidents committed in the weeks since the election. The next attorney general must recognize that hate crimes exist and vigorously investigate them.
Secretary of Education nominee Betsy DeVos donated $200,000 to the successful campaign to constitutionally ban civil marriage equality in her home state of Michigan. She and her wealthy family organizations have made hefty donations of $500,000 to the Anti-Equality National Organization for Marriage and $100,000 to the equally anti-equality group Florida for Marriage.
Secretary of Health and Human Services nominee Tom Price has an anti-LGBTQ record to rival that of Alabama Senator Sessions. Price, a Georgia congressman, is a leading sponsor of the First Amendment Defense Act. Like a number of state laws, it's a national-level bill that would allow individuals and businesses to discriminate against people they don't approve of, i.e. LGBT people, based on sincerely held religious belief.
National Security Advisor nominee Michael Flynn served in a similar capacity during Trump's election campaign. He's notoriously right of center, even for the military, and has made numerous Islamophobic comments. Flynn recently railed against the Obama administration for lifting the ban on transgender military personnel.
Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of Defense, former General James Mad Dog Mattis, has opposed allowing LGBT people and women to serve in the military. President Barack Obama fired him in 2013 for being too hawkish on Iran. By law, Congress has to waive a requirement that the top civilian leader of the U.S. military must have been retired from the armed forces for at least 7 years. Some Democratic lawmakers have already expressed opposition to that waiver for Mattis.
Last but significantly not least, incoming White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus led the Republican National Committee to its most anti-queer platform in decades. The convention-approved policy statement opposes a ban on so-called cure therapy for LGBTQ minors, maintains its opposition to marriage and adoptions equality, and supports so-called religious freedom laws. Priebus defended the platform earlier this year, falsely claiming that children raised by same-gender couples are more likely to be drawn to drugs and crime.
Elsewhere, and
that was This Way Out reporting on Trump's cabinet picks, proposed picks. The Senate will take that up in a number of weeks, deciding whether those folks are welcome to take the positions Trump has nominated them for. I want to end the show with by listening in on a KPFD Houston Radio Queers Voices discussion on anti-trans and anti-gay legislation in Texas. Texas is just one of any number of places in this country where conservative and right-wing politicians and their enablers are coming out strong season after season, and they may now have the backing of the federal government if some people's guesses about what these folks in Trump's cabinet are looking to accomplish. So I thought we'd spend these last minutes listening in on this conversation about what it can really look like when politicians come after queer and trans folks. Thanks, everyone.
This is Queer Voices.
This is Brian Levinka, and we have kind of a really bad legislative session coming 2017. And apologies, we were supposed to have Mike Webb in tonight in the studio to talk about this. He's moderating the discussion, but he is in Austin working for Sylvia Garcia. So we wanted to have someone in the flesh and live in the studio. In the studio, we got the president of the GOBT Political Caucus, Fran Watson.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Okay, so there's a legislative community forum coming up soon. Can you tell us about what it is and what the objective is and kind of who you'll be talking to? Give us kind of an idea.
Yeah, sure. So what we're doing is the caucus, you know, in addition to what we're known for, which is endorsing candidates, one of the things that we're seeking to do is really, one, get the membership, the community, LGBTQ community, together with our elected officials, because regardless of who we vote for, once they're in office, you know, they're elected to vote for all the people. And then so what we decided at the end of the year, that what we would do, knowing that this is going to be such an intense legislative session in 2017, is to get a Houston delegate together to come and talk to the people. And we're partnering up with Legacy, because Legacy deals with, as a community health center, they many of the issues that they take on has to do with the LGBTQ community. So it was just a natural partnership. And so what we're doing is we're having elected officials and also some representatives in various communities. And since the caucus is a nonpartisan organization, we'll have representation from both sides of the aisle. So we'll be having Senator Sylvia Garcia will be on the panel. Also, Representative Sarah Davis will be on the panel.
Who's a Republican.
Who is Republican, yes.
Okay, so we're reaching out across the aisle.
Reaching out across the aisles. We'll have Representative Garnett Coleman and Representative Sophronia Thompson. We'll also have representation from the Texas Association of Businesses. So what we're doing is that this is a community forum. This isn't one of those forums where people, where the elected officials will just do all of the talking. But we know that after the election and with the political climate, there is some fear, there's concerns. And so we'll have, so then the community will be able to ask these questions.
So is there, I guess you talked about the fear. Is there more fear now that we have kind of this Republican president that has an anti-LGBT vice president, along with all of his appointments that are now coming in? Is there more fear now what's going to happen in Texas?
Oh, my gosh. Before the election even occurred, we had already seen that the lieutenant governor was inserting himself into local affairs and really doing things to try to regress the LGBTQ community, specifically the trans community, in education and in healthcare. And now that there's this look that the Texas legislature and the executive branch mirror or match what's happening at the federal level with the president-elect Trump, then there's just this people are just going forward without any disregard for what's going on. I mean, we already have bills that are being introduced.
Let's talk about some of this crazy legislation that's coming out that we're learning about now.
Right. We already have three Senate bills that are that have been filed in there that are anti-LGBT. And we have one. We have the Senate Bill 92, which is prohibiting any local authority for providing non-discrimination protections not otherwise provided in state law.
So I guess, does that affect Houston since we we don't have that?
Right. It does affect
Houston. We don't have it. We'll never have it.
We'll never have it, right? So what they're doing is not only are they trying to prevent, one, they're preventing and repealing the laws that are, trying to repeal the laws that are in place already.
The cities that already have those protections, mm-hmm. like
San Antonio, Austin, Dallas, who even enhanced their protections.
So that would rescind all of that.
Yes, wow. Yes. And then prevent us, Houston, from going again.
What is the reasoning behind that? What, I mean, why would you want to take away protections for people? I mean, what is their case for that?
The issue that's happening is that it continuously goes back to this anti-trans legislation, this anti-trans movement. You saw that during HERO last year. Gosh.
I think this was like the testing ground for that, it feels like.
Yes, yes. I mean, they're attacking trans children, they're attacking adults, and it's just going in and vilifying this community.
But, I mean, it's taking down all the LG and the B, too.
Yeah, exactly. And so instead of, like, it's very disheartening because you're trying to stop folks, trying to stop people from just trying to live their life because of your confusion on people's lives.
Right. And they have to go to the bathroom anyway. I mean,
I know. And
what are they supposed to do?
The thing is that it's constantly talking, right? I know that there's this hashtag out that says classroom, not bathrooms.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's the thing. This is none of this has to do with bathrooms. People are just trying to work and live.
It's just hate.
It's just hate. It's just this continuously going after some type of some community in some way, whether it'll be.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public